what we talk about, or what we're fearing in life, the risk that we perceive in life, it really drives so much of how we perceive life. Our ability to enjoy the ride, our ability to enjoy life, is all about the risk that we perceive in life. And that tendency of Christians to always end up talking about the doctrine of hell, always end up talking about, oh, really what it is that is an anxiety, that's a fear, that's an underlying stress that we have. Are we really saved? Are we really accepted? Does God really love me that much that I'm okay, that this is all going to be all right in the end? I like that image of going on a thrill ride at Disneyland or anywhere. And we love to get scared. We love to go on the ride. But because we trust the designers and OSHA and the construction engineers and everybody else, we know that at the end of that ride, we're going to get off and Mom and Dad are going to be waving and it's going to be great. But if for one instant on that ride, we saw a missing section of track ahead of us, if for one instance we felt the bolts loosening on our seat, we would cease to enjoy that ride. What is it that allows us to be able to have the confidence that we're going to survive this greatest of all thrill rides, this life of ours, and be able to enjoy it? I mean, that's what we're really talking about here. The transformed life is a life that has learned to trust that place that will allow the enjoyment of the life. How do we do that? There is a scripture that I want to have as a center of this morning, and it's John 8:32. And you can go there if you want to, but I'm going to read it. 31 and 32, then Jesus said to those Jews who believed him, "If you abide in my word, you are my disciples indeed, and you shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free." Don't you love that? But what does that mean? I mean, really, when it comes right down to it, you shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. It sounds great. It sounds hopeful in a vague sort of way. But let's try to make it concrete if we can. Everybody, you're sitting there right now, stop for a second, close your eyes, and just become aware of your breathing. Feel it rise, feel it fall. It's smooth, it's silent, it's always there. But I'll bet that until the moment I told you to become aware of your breathing, you were not aware at all that it was taking place. Unless maybe you have asthma, maybe you have a cold right now. If your breathing is obstructed, if there is some reason that it's difficult for you, then you're thinking about it. But when all is going well, nothing. It's just there. Even when you're asleep, your body still breathes. It doesn't forget to breathe. When is something really free? I want to submit to you that something is really free when you don't have to think about it. When you don't have to worry about it. When you don't have to plan for it. When you don't have to budget for it. When you don't have to pay for it. When you don't even have to think about something and it is there for you, that is when it is truly free. And you're always free from something, right? You may be free from the law in one sense. You may be free from having to pay for something in another sense. It's free of cost. Maybe you're free as a bird. You're free from obligation. You're free from responsibility. That's what that one means. But you're always free from something. So to be set free is to be liberated from that thing that causes you to think about it, to plan for it, to worry about it, to budget for it. All that stuff that you have to fight over to gain something makes it not free. I love the Christopherson song, "Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose." You know, it's stated in the negative, but really it's true. When you get right down to it, when there is nothing left to lose, when you don't have to think or worry or plan or budget, then that thing is really free. So, you are most free from the thing that you don't have to think about, plan for, worry about, stress over, pay for. those are the things that you're going to be most free from. And the thing that we think about the most, conversely, plan for, worry about, is the thing that owns us, the thing that enslaves us. Those are the things that take away our freedom. Now, in another place, Jesus said, you can't serve God and mammon. You can't serve two masters. That word mammon usually is translated as wealth or riches, which is a good translation of the word. But you know where it originally came from? It came from a transliterated, untranslated Aramaic word, mamona, which was really the name of a Canaanite deity of riches and wealth. And the idea behind the word is that the wealth, mamona, mammon, the things in your life that you pile up in your life, and that eventually you become defined by, that's mammon. So think about what it is that you pile up in your life that defines you. What is it? What are the things that you think about the most, worry about the most, plan for the most, spend the most money on? That's your mammon. Those are the things that own you. Those are the things that keep you from being set free. And we can all go through that exercise. You know, what is it? In a positive way, is it your family? Is it your children? Your wife? Your husband? Is it a love relationship? Money or lack of money? Your job? Your next drink? Your next fix? Whatever it is that you spend the most time thinking about, those are the things that you are not free from. And this truth is supposed to set us free. Now, let me ask you another question. Are we supposed to be completely free? Are we supposed to be completely free from law? Are we supposed to be completely free from obligation? Responsibility? If you really think about it, to be completely free is to be completely alone. If I treated my relationship with my wife the way I treat my breathing, I guarantee you I would be alone. If I never thought about her, if I never worried about her, if I never cared for her, if I never planned for her, if I never paid for anything for her, if I didn't do those things, if I was completely free from my wife, I wouldn't have one. Now think about in this country. Are we completely free in this country? We're losing more personal freedoms all the time. Since 9/11, the amount of personal freedoms that we have lost in the name of the greater security and the common good against the threat of terrorism or whatever is astronomical. But it's a trade-off that we make. So we trade freedom for something. We trade freedom for relationship. We trade freedom for having someone in our life. And then we trade freedom for security. Those are the main things that we trade freedom for. And that's a good trade. If we weren't limiting our freedom under law, we couldn't live together. It would be anarchy. You know, the buses wouldn't run on time. You wouldn't get your bills in the mail. Your bills. You wouldn't get your checks in the mail. You know, you'd get your bills probably no matter what happens, but you wouldn't get your checks. We could not function as a group. We could not function as families, and we could not function as couples without the limiting of our freedom, giving up freedom. So no, we're not supposed to be completely free. And that's okay. But that's not exactly what Jesus is talking about here, is it? You know, in the truth that will set us free. What is it that we're actually supposed to be free from in John 8:32? The clues are in the language. There are four closely related terms in the Aramaic and even in the Greek that are going to give us clues as to what Jesus is talking about here. The first is the idea of being set free in itself, to liberate, to release, or to deliver, the word used there. There's a great story, and you probably mostly have all heard it, but I'm going to say it anyway for anyone who hasn't or for the recording. There's a man on a roof with the floodwaters coming up, and the waters are already to the eaves of the house, and a paddle boat comes by, and they say, get in, we'll save you. And he says, nope, God's going to save me. And go on by. Helicopter goes by, they throw down the rope ladder. Come on, climb on up, we're going to save you. Nope, God's going to save me. Motorboat comes by, come on, you know, come aboard, we'll save you. Nope, God's going to save me. Floodwaters come up, cover the house, man drowns. Still goes to heaven, you know. But when he gets there, he says, God, why didn't you save me? God says, I sent you two boats and a helicopter, what more did you want? This idea of, as well, as sort of an aside, God loves us through each other. You know, we ask for God to help us, and when the help comes, we don't recognize it. Why? Because it didn't come in the expected form, maybe, that we were looking for or whatever. And just as importantly, we love God through each other. Do you think we love God directly? I'd say think again. Is it really through the forms and the rituals of our religious practice? Is it really when we sing songs that we're loving God? We're loving God when we're loving each other. Our relationship with each other is a marker, a monitor of the quality of our relationship with God. All this happens through each other. That's a digression, though. The idea of the man on the roof being delivered, taken out of his circumstances, taken out of his situation, in such a way that his life is preserved, is the idea not only of liberation, but to the Jews, also salvation. We think of salvation as being able to go to heaven and not go to hell. To the Jew, to be delivered from whatever calamity exists in your circumstances right now, that's salvation. It's right here and right now. To liberate, to set free, is the same as to save. And the word to save, heya, in the Aramaic, comes from the word, the same roots as haye, which means life. And so literally, to save means to give life, to save life, to preserve life. It's all about life as it exists right here and right now. So salvation and liberation are very closely related. They're almost synonymous in the terms. Now there's a third term, and this one may surprise you a bit. This is the word that means to judge. Now, as soon as we think of judge, we think of it as a legal term, right? It's the arbitration, it's the decision between something according to the law. So the judge is going to make that decision with the law as the reference as to what happens in a given circumstance. But if you think about the judges of ancient Israel, they might fill that role, but that wasn't their primary role. Their primary role was to rule or to govern, and mostly it was to deliver. The judges of the Old Testament, before the kings were set up, were warrior rulers. Warriors who came at a time of crisis and rallied what needed to be rallied and delivered the people from whatever threat was coming. Judgment, then, is really deliverance in a primary way of looking at it from the Hebrew and from the Aramaic. The judgment of God that we shake and rattle and roll about is really the deliverance of God. Same as salvation and the same as liberation. All these terms are very similar. It doesn't mean when you read judgment in the Bible, it's not talking about a legal sort of judgment. Sometimes it is. But very often, God's judgment. God is called a judge in Genesis 18. Remember when Abraham is negotiating with God for the saving or delivering the people of Sodom and Gomorrah? He calls him judge. And that is not judge in a legal sense. That's judge in the sense of deliverance. You are the judge, God. Won't you deliver these people from this fate? Moses is called judge, deliverer, in Exodus 18, dealing with everything that he did to deliver the people out of the situation they were in. So we've got three terms. We've got salvation, we've got liberation, we've got judgment. And then, in a fascinating turn, if you look at the word that means release in Aramaic, it's sebach. And liberation as a noun would be subkana. These words are the words that are used when Jesus, remember when he reads the Isaiah scroll and he talks about his mission statement. He says, I was sent here to bring sight to the blind and release to the captives. That word release, liberation of the captives, is subkana. When he says in Matthew 6, Father, forgive us our sins, in the Lord's Prayer, as we put it, forgive us our trespasses, that word forgive there is also sebach. And forgiveness is subkana. It is the same word. The word that means forgiveness, the word that means liberation, is the same exact word. This starts to get really interesting, because then to be set free, to be liberated, is to be forgiven. And to be forgiven is to be set free. To be forgiven and set free is to be saved, or delivered, or judged. Salvation is to be set free from anything that would keep us from returning to our original state. That's what forgiveness really is, a return to the original state that existed before something happened to change that state. To be set free from that thing that changed our original state, to bring us back into our original state, is what forgiveness is. All four of those terms are connecting at that level. And what was that original state? It was unity. It was perfect relationship. It was the garden. We're all trying to get back to the garden in some way or another form, right? That is what forgiveness allows us to do, is to get back to the garden. So, what is it that we're being set free from? We're being set free from all the things that we think about and worry about and plan for and budget for and think we have to pay our way through that keep us from just the unity and the connectedness of perfect, easy relationship. The relationship with God is free. We don't have to pay for it, think about it, worry about it, but we do. But this truth is going to cure all that. This truth is going to allow us not to have to worry. Well, what then is the truth that is going to make this happen? The word for truth is serara, or serara. And literally from the roots of that word, what it means is that which liberates. Imagine that. That which opens possibilities. A right or harmonious direction. That is truth. So now it's sort of what you call a tautology, when you put two equal things on either side of the equal sign. You know. That which sets free, sets free. I mean, really, that's the equation of what Jesus is saying. When he says the truth will set you free, that which sets free opens up the possibilities of freedom, is what actually sets you free. And for Jesus, the truth is simply the good news. That was the truth of his gospel. That's what, in the context of this saying, what he was telling them, was everything that I'm teaching you, all this good news that I'm giving you, is the truth that will set you free from everything that blocks you from the relationship that you can and should have with God. And so this good news is that God's love is free. You don't have to think about it or worry about it. But there's nothing that you can do to lose it. There's nothing you can do to attenuate it. There's nothing you can do to amplify it. It is that perfect thing. And there's nothing that we can do to change that fact. There's nothing that we can do not to be forgiven. And this might be a tough one for some of you. But there's nothing we can do not to be forgiven except not want the forgiveness in the first place. The unforgivable sin is only unforgivable because we reject the possibility of forgiveness. That's what makes it unforgivable. God will never reject us. So the only way to be rejected is to reject God and keep on rejecting Him forever. That's the unforgivable sin. You can't commit it by mistake. You have to know exactly what you're doing, willfully. Willfully. And so the good news is that thing. Back to the suburbs of hell. The essay contained a lot of the elements that we're talking about right now. And I figured, you know, to me this seems like a no-brainer. I was really surprised, especially in dealing with these ideas that we should not fear God. We should not fear our relationship or our standing with God. Got a lot of negative comments back. It was published in neglected to say this. It was published in an online magazine. And so there's this forum and you can reply to it and comment. And I got lots of negative comments back. It really surprised me, but they were fascinating in the way that they were being responded to. But one of them that was my favorite in reference to this idea that we shouldn't fear God. The guy simply said, good grief, you can't have the good news without the bad news. I didn't reply to him, but if I had, this is what I would have said. The good news is there is no bad news. That's what it is. We have to understand that the good news means there is no bad news. There is no way to lose this love that God has for us. There is no way to lose the connection and the ongoing acceptance and relationship that we can have right now and that can extend into eternity if we simply will accept it. It's like Jesus looking down at Jerusalem saying, my children, how I have longed to be able to gather you under my wings as a hen gathers her chicks, but you would not. That is the only thing that's keeping us from this relationship is, will we? God's love is free. But until we know the truth, Jesus says, we will not be set free. When you know the truth, you'll be set free. Now that doesn't mean when you believe the truth, when you know the truth, and there's a difference. And we've talked about this in here before too. The word for know, yada in Hebrew, yada in Aramaic, doesn't mean to know in your head about something. It means to be able to handle it. It comes from the same root as the root for hands. When you know something in an Aramaic Hebrew sense, you are able to handle it. You have experience with it. It's the way a carpenter knows the weight and feel of his hammer even when it's not in his hand. It's the way a lover knows the shape of their beloved's face and can feel it and their hands ache for it when it's not there. That is knowing. It even extended into sexual intercourse when Adam knew his wife and she gave birth. When you go into your tent and you know someone, you know them intimately and you know them in a way that words and ideas cannot express. It's beneath that. So, belief is idea. Faith is action. Trust is experience. When we believe something deeply enough in our mind that we can actually go out into our lives, take actions, make choices, and live as if that thing were already true, take the risks in life as if that thing were already true, that's faith, and not before. From belief to faith. And then when we do go out in our life and we experience the things we experience as we live believing and as if this thing were already true, we get experiences of God's trustworthiness that makes us know that we know that we know that these things are true. Until we experience that, until we've taken the risk because our belief grew into faith, there is no way to know the truth. How do you know if you know the truth? It's real simple. Are you enjoying the ride? Are you having fun yet? The only way to have fun, the only way to enjoy the ride is to know the truth. To know that you're going to survive the thrill ride. That you're going to get off at the other side and your father is going to be waiting for you. And it's going to be all right. That's knowing the truth. And that sets you free. When we no longer have to think, plan, worry, live our lives in the suburbs of hell, worried about what is going to happen. When we're not trying to pay our way through doing whatever mitzvahs and good deeds and things that we think we need to do in order to gain God's acceptance, when all that goes away and we can just get down to just knowing that everything is fine, that even the risks and the difficult things that we face in life are going to work out okay one way or another, and in the final analysis we're going to be connected with God in a way that we can't even imagine or describe. The peace that passes all understanding will be ours, and it starts right now. How do you do this? I can't tell you that. But if you can start to understand the concepts that we're talking about, you can start to take the first steps toward just letting this stuff go where it needs to go when you know the truth, you'll be set free from everything that stands in the way of the perfect relationship, not only with God, but with everybody else around you. And then you're going to start enjoying it. You know, I think if I could tell you any one thing that may help moving forward on this kind of journey, it would be to understand that we as Westerners, as the descendants of Greek philosophy and Roman law, are basically legalists. We really can't help it. Everything is approached in our society from a legal point of view. You know, we are conditioned to have a right and a wrong, a black and a white, you know, an on and an off. And we're on one side or the other, and somebody has to judge what side we are on. And that is what the legal system does. And unfortunately, that gets transferred to our God. The way we interpret our scriptures is in the light of that legal mentality, mindset, and worldview. So we automatically see God as the great judge in the sky who's going to be the final arbiter of heaven or hell, where we go. That is not a comforting person. That is not a person that you can really get warm and fuzzy with and trust to have your best interests at heart. Because when it comes right down to it, we want mercy and not justice. And fortunately, that is God's basic mode of dealing with us. He deals with us in mercy and compassion. Justice in the macro, for the masses, has to be maintained, or else there is no compassion or mercy at all. But God deals with us one-on-one, and in the micro of that relationship, He has the luxury of being merciful and not merely just. So try to get over that idea of legality only. And our understanding of judgment is part and parcel to that. Because in our thinking, God is being described over and over again as the judge, and His judgment is this arbitration, this decision. And yet, the idea is more one of deliverance and salvation and liberation. So to try to get past that, to see that mercy and compassion is the basic mode with which God is dealing with us and not justice, goes a long way for us to be able to trust enough to take the journey that Grendel was talking about, to start to risk some of the things, to experiment, to try, to move out and see what God will do. What is the fastest way to grow any organization? You got the carrot and you got the stick. That's the fastest way. Either promise everybody what they want to have promised, tell them what they want to hear, tell them that God is going to heal and God is going to take care of all their problems if they will just do such and so. Or you scare them to death with the promise of destruction and damnation if they don't. You know, the carrot and the stick. But again, that's the same kind of binary duality that we are prone to as Westerners, that the Eastern mindset from which Jesus comes was not a part of. They looked at things as a unity. They looked at things as a holistic whole. And there was one thing at the foundation of all creation, not two things. You know, there wasn't good and evil, right and wrong. You know, so there was one thing, just God, unity. And if we can start to think along those lines, maybe it'll give us enough of a break from our fears to be able to take some risk and find out what's going on out there. And eventually, to enjoy a ride. To see this life as an adventure and not just a drudgery. Not just something that we have to get through in order to pass the finish line with enough points to get into heaven. Because really, that's the mindset when it comes right down to it. You know, I think that's the key. That falling in love with God is sort of really the same thing that we're talking about here. Because now we're enjoying the ride. We've crossed a threshold where we're not just loving as a decision, but we're loving in a way that is just absolutely breathtaking. And that's where we need to go. But how scary is it to fall in love with someone? And all that implies, you know, all the potential heartache and rejection and hurt that you open yourself up to when you open yourself up to somebody like that. It's the same thing with God. We feel the same sort of risk. What takes us past the risk? Well, when the person is right in front of us, there are all sorts of things that we see as worth the risk. We've got to start seeing God in the same way. And until we can stop seeing him as merely a judge and as a true lover in every sense of the word, it's going to be hard to get past the amount of risk that we feel. That's it. And that's what the song is describing. Is that breakpoint where you move past. And that's where we all need to get.